Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, good afternoon and greetings. Thanks for coming along for the Wednesday edition of The Ride Home. I'm happy to report that the Zing is back in studio. Kath, welcome back from sick bay.
Thank you, John.
You're still not fully recovered.
No, my voice is a little wacky.
Well,
This was a head cold. I haven't had a head cold like this in years.
Mm-hmm.
Years. It just, like, I don't have a cough, which is great.
Yep.
Don't have any of the chest congestion. None of that. Wasn't like when I had COVID. This was just your garden variety gigantic head cold.
So you weren't here. So yesterday I traced the lineage of...
Oh, of the virus.
Right,
did you?
Where my son working in... His coworker, George, gave it to my son.
George.
My son gave it to me. I gave it to you.
Yeah.
So it all goes back to George.
Thanks a lot, George.
What the heck? I've never met you, but I've got your germs,
exactly.
My friend.
Now, Lexi, I haven't given it to you.
Mm. Yeah. Keep your sickness away from
yeah,
me.
Yeah. She praises the glass that separates
I'm
us.
I'm drinking vitamin C as right. we speak.
Oh, very good. And there's a gigantic Clorox. This is kind of shades of the pandemic.
This is. There's a huge Clorox thing.
Yeah. It's like right. the wipe thing.
The wipe.
Like that's going to do something.
I hate that. Well, of course, it's a disinfecting wipe.
What, I'm going to put like one in my mouth?
Well,
right? Is that what's going to happen?
I don't think that's recommended.
Heck. Anyway, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
I'm very glad to mm-hmm. be back. I have tea. A couple things have fallen apart in my absence. One being the ice cube production.
Oh.
You know, when I get in here,
yeah.
In the morning I make ice cubes.
Yeah.
And today I noticed that there's been some slippage.
Really?
No one has filled in my
what
absence.
What is the deal with that? No
That's
one's
sad.
So you take cubes from the tray. We're doing the old fashioned
yeah,
tray.
Right.
And then you don't fill the trays back up.
I mean, isn't that something that your mom teaches you when you're like 11?
I would hope so. So yeah. Who's the victim?
I don't know.
Well, you're the victim.
I'm
the
victim.
Perpetrator?
Who's the perpetrator is the right. bigger question.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I said to Lex, oh, hey, look, you know, here's the daily calendar and here's the top four. She said, oh, this is kind of like when your mom goes away and your dad's there and chaos reigns.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, man, your dad just doesn't know what to feed you. So he's like, here's some cup noodles. I'll bake a pizza.
Yeah. The SpaghettiO edition of The Ride Home.
That's so funny.
Very good.
Coming up on today's program, we're excited to have Jay Warner Wallace back with us. He's one of our oldest friends
mm-hmm.
As far as the show goes. He's got a new book out called The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. I'm really excited.
Me too.
To read this book.
He's excellent.
Jay Warner Wallace is a cold case detective. He's been featured on Dateline a bunch of times. He's a friend of the program, so we're going to talk to him about that at 5:10. Also, the announcement from the Vatican on Dignity's Infinita.
Mm-hmm.
Infinita.
Yes.
Infinita. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it. But Dr. Charlie Camosi is going to be on to kind of break it down for us. It's a statement on human dignity.
AI,
mm-hmm. and the contemporary issues that surround it.
So whether you follow the Vatican or care about the Vatican at all, their pronouncements about theological life, I think, are important to all of us.
Yes. And then coming up in this hour, the discoverer of the God particle has passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll break that down a little bit, as much as my small mind can handle, especially still congested. And college students are making marriage pacts.
Very nice. Also, we're going to talk about a religion convention, religion reporters and writers headed to Pittsburgh. Straight ahead.
Yeah, right.
Okay, without further ado, let's take a look at the news, Kath. I missed a few days.
Did you?
So here's the top four at four.
I'm just making my tea, John,
very
as
nice.
I look at the top four.
A little Dunkin' going on.
I feel like I just need a little bit of, yeah. This is Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. Number one, Norfolk Southern agreed yesterday to a $600 million settlement to resolve a class action lawsuit related to the February 2023 train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, that spilled and burned hazardous chemicals. The agreement settles class action claims for residents and businesses within a 20-mile radius. Personal injury claims also for residents within a 10-mile radius, providing payouts the plaintiffs can use in any manner they see fit to address potential adverse impacts from the derailment. Mm. The settlement still needs to be approved by a judge. That's from today's dispatch. Number two, Republican lawmakers in Tennessee advanced a proposal Tuesday to allow some teachers to carry handguns on public school grounds, a move that will mark one of the state's biggest expansions of gun access since a deadly shooting at the private elementary school that happened last year. The proposal cleared the GOP-controlled chamber amid emotional chants and screams from protesters against it. Many were eventually ordered to leave the gallery. After receiving a 26-5 party line Senate vote, the proposal is now ready for the House floor vote. It's kind of interesting, John, to read how people have argued about this and how they even argued on the gallery floor. Only a handful of GOP senators spoke in favor of the bill, even though it was, you know, the amount. All of a sudden, we're playing $25,000 pyramid. No, the amount is, it was passed, not unanimously, but pretty close to it. But only a handful of GOP senators spoke in favor of it. But they took the time to stress that teachers wouldn't be required to be armed or use their weapons in active shooter situations. They argued that it could be helpful in rural counties with limited police presence. Then they went on to say that a worker who wants to carry a handgun would need to have a handgun carry permit, have written authorization from both the school's principal and local law enforcement, a clear background check, and undergo 40 hours of handgun training. While you're also being a teacher,
yes.
Right? We're sending teachers, this is a quote, to learn how to handle a combat situation that veteran law enforcement have trouble comprehending.
Yeah. I mean, the front lines.
Yeah. So
you're teaching dangling participles.
Exactly. And after your 40 hours of handgun training. I just think that's a lot to put on a teacher.
Some people will step forward
right. And
carry a gun.
But
okay.
I bet most won't.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, how much can... So we're going to have teachers... I'm just going off on all of a sudden the opinion page. Back to the news. Number three.
Thank you.
The Arizona Supreme Court's decision on Tuesday to uphold a near-total abortion ban predating Arizona statehood has drawn differing reactions from state Republicans who previously claimed to be, quote, 100% pro-life, while both local and national Democrats vowed to push to protect abortion access in one of the most politically important states on the 2024 map. Vice President Kamala Harris is planning to travel to Tucson Friday for her fight for reproductive freedoms, where she's expected to continue to squarely blame former President Trump for appointing three of the justices who voted to overrule Roe versus Wade. Read more about that in today's ABC News. And number four, our state, Pennsylvania, on its way to becoming the next state to ban the use of handheld cell phones while driving. The House on Tuesday voted 124-77. Margin is the word I was looking for.
Thank you.
Seconds back.
There it is.
124-77 to approve an amended version of a Senate-passed bill championed by Senator Rosemary Brown, Republican of Monroe County, that would make it illegal for a driver to use handheld electronic devices while operating a vehicle in an effort to combat distracted driving. And that is your top four.
All right. Well, good luck with that.
It's essential. I think we just have to take...
How do you enforce something like that?
Well, I mean, if somebody sees you on your phone,
yeah,
then they call the cops. But then how are they going to do it?
Cops,
because they're going to be holding their own phone.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. You don't think it's important? Well, of course you think it's important.
Yeah, but how do you enforce something like that? I mean, seriously, it's a circus out there on the roads. So we're going to add one more layer?
It would prohibit a driver from being charged with both using a handheld device and texting while driving if they're stopped at the same time in the same place. So you can only be charged for one. It would bar law enforcement from seizing an electronic device unless otherwise provided for. And it would define using an interactive mobile device as holding it with at least one hand or supporting it with part of your body. Right. It wouldn't count if you're using it for nav. Mm.
We'll see. Right. I'm very skeptical of the whole thing. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Come back next week. The Religion News Association is holding their annual conference, their 75th anniversary conference.
We're going to be there.
Here in our very fine city of Pittsburgh. So stay tuned for that. We're going to talk with a religion reporter, Ken Chitwood, who is a professional religion nerd just like us, and perhaps you as well. Stick around. It's The Ride Home, or Pittsburgh's Christian Talk on Word FM. What is it like to spend your professional career reporting on religion? Next week, the Religion News Association comes to the city of Pittsburgh for their 75th anniversary conference. They meet annually, and it's people like Kath and myself, and perhaps you as well, who is a religion nerd. Well, Ken Chitwood is with us. He's a professional religion nerd, working on scholar and news writer. He is president of the Religion News Association, the premier membership association for journalists reporting on religion. Also, editor of Religion Link, faith and immigration reporter for Sojourners Magazine, and European correspondent for Christianity Today. Ken, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on to talk about religion nerddom coming to Pittsburgh.
Very nice.
Well, first of all, we're very excited that you're coming to Pittsburgh. Hopefully you're going to be here. It's going to be terrific weather, and you're going to enjoy the city. But let's talk about this religion nerddom. So you've been working as a scholar, as a news writer for a long time. How did you get into it, or was it kind of by accident?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a religion nerd since I grew up in the Los Angeles urban area. And as I often say, I dated my way through the world's religions. And so my various partners when I was in high school were Buddhist, or they came from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or they were pagan. They were all types of things. And my friends were Muslim and Jewish. So I always had an interest. But what's really great is I often always say, too, that Religion News Association gave me my career as a religion nerd. Mm. Because when I first showed up there 13 years ago at a conference in 2011, I was just a blogger. You know, I guess I would have started a podcast if it was these days. But I was just a blogger at the Houston Chronicle. And I met this wonderful community of people who encouraged my writing, showed me where to go, launched me into my PhD eventually, which grew out of a religion story I wrote for the Houston Chronicle. And so it's really been that community that's fostered this interest professionally and helped make it possible.
Yeah. I love this because it is true. It is a wonderful experience to be sort of, you know, hip deep in the beauty and the variety of the world's religions. And so you take it a step further and make it your life's work. Now, Kath and I have been doing this show for a long, long time. There's something that's deeply powerful about this. I mean, in some ways, of course,
it is compelling.
It really is. Mm. And, you know, it's a barometer of the culture in some ways. And especially you see what's happened in the last, you know, decade or so. But there is a lot of power here. Does it inform you? I'm sure it does, right? Talk to us about how it informs your faith, draws you closer or keeps you at a distance in some way.
Yeah, I talk a lot about being kind of a cosmopolitan stranger, never quite at home in the place that I come from, but also always being that person just kind of sojourning through in the places that I visit. And I really love that. I love being in that space of discomfort that is also comfortable, mm-hmm. right? So I think it expands my horizons. It's pushed me beyond Los Angeles. And that environment, you know, beyond just dating my way through the world's religions. But, I guess I kind of still do date the world religions. It's kind of like religion speed dating. You know, just today talking to a representative of evangelicals at the European Parliament, and then later today speaking to a Catholic priest on the border. And then tomorrow I'm talking to Zoroastrians who are celebrating some of their spring festivals and the outcomes of that in particular context. And it's like, you know, every day is so different. It's so diverse. And I really thrive in it. And personally, my faith has grown from it, definitely.
Mm. Excellent.
Okay, so let me take the other tack, which is, as John said, that he and I have been doing this for a long time. I often find religion stories incredibly depressing. I mean, when you talk about the abuse stories, when you talk about the financial mismanagement stories, how about the stories about just, you know, pastors who have power complexes, who have celebrity followings in their churches, the kinds of stuff that the internet has really encouraged, which is putting a person who has incredible gifts of charisma or whatever on a platform and then giving them a ton of attention, and how negative that is for the person, him or herself.
The dark side of it all.
The dark side of it is really dark.
Yeah, I mean, religion stories are first and foremost human stories. And so they're going to have all the good, bad, and in between of what it means to be human. And there's going to be scandalous religion topics, and there's going to be tough topics to discuss, topics that are highly polarized. And what I really appreciate about being a religion reporter and our community of religion reporters is that we're always willing to go there, whatever kind of story it is. And in particular, the members of RNA make sure we get the details right. So we're not just looking for the scandalous headlines. We're not just looking for the dark side of the story in order to draw people to read or to get people to pay attention.
Yeah.
We're really trying to tell the human texture and the deeper narrative and bring out the humanity of these stories, whether that's because there's this negative wake that's been left or because something exemplary has happened and we want to shine a light on that as well. And so I think we really cover the breadth and the depth of these religion stories, no matter how bad they may be or no matter how inspiring they may be.
We're talking with Ken Chitwood. He is the president of Religion News Association. It's the premier membership association for journalists reporting on religion. RNA is in town next week in Pittsburgh here for their 75th anniversary conference. Ken, let's talk about that. I mean, you're inviting professionals in like yourself, and you're also saying, well, this is open to the general public if you're interested in religion reporting. Talk about the conference itself. I mean, 75 years, that's a heck of a long time to get religion nerds together. But you go into conferences and you tackle a lot of different topics.
We do. I mean, that's one of the really fun things about this conference. It's not only a religion nerd prom in a way where we get together and hang out and talk with one another and catch up. I mean, it's very rare, I should say, that there's a whole religion section at a publication or a broadcast news organization. There are some that do, like the Religion News Service or the Associated Press or some of the bigger papers, large newspaper services have a few people reporting on religion. But for a lot of us, we're spread out across the United States, spread out across the globe. And so this is an opportunity for us to get together. And then beyond that, we decide to talk about things like covering the impact of the Israel-Hamas war in your community or talking about the dark side of religion, scandalous things happening in religious communities, and how to go from rumors to sources, documents, and video. We talk about the legacy of the Rwanda genocide 30 mm-hmm. years on, and understanding Muslim frustrations about reporting Islamophobia. And so it's really fun to connect, but then we take on these very serious topics and it gets very in-depth very quickly and can be also very tense very quickly, depending upon who's on the panels. But that's what makes the RNA conference so exciting, is that not only are we gathering as news writers, we're watching news happen in the room as people talk to one another, share their stories, and share their perspectives.
Yeah. Ken, I'm sure you've seen this develop just as John and I have, that people seem more eager than ever to have that kind of tension online, right? Particularly in social media when it comes to issues like that. But people seem more reluctant to me than ever to have those conversations in person. And I think that hurts us. I wish we could flip that around. I wish people would be willing to have an uncomfortable conversation, maybe for 4 minutes, maybe for 40 minutes or whatever, but you don't have to have it forever, and just be able to honestly say what they think about something without feeling like the other person's going to jump on them or that they're going to lose part of their allegiance, to whatever they believe in by having a conversation with someone who doesn't share their views.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a trend that's developed, and I think we're all pretty aware of it, both personally and professionally. And we also at the RNA conference have what we call our shadow conference, which is the conference conversation happening online. And we love our shadow conference because there's a lot of people that can't be there for one reason or another. And this is a way for them to stay connected. And we're live tweeting quotes from the panels and people are reacting to them in real time. That's really fun. It also can get really tense. And I think we've seen the most kind of difficulty around having conversations of this sort on the shadow conference, on Twitter, online. But if you were to be there in the room at the conference, you'd hear the journalists asking really tough questions, critical questions of the people on these panels who are sometimes saying controversial things. But then later, people are all going out and singing karaoke together and connecting as human beings as well. And then going even deeper into these conversations, but in a really nuanced and textured way that I really appreciate. And what makes being at the RNA conference really so valuable is that human touch and that human conversation.
That's what we need, right? We need the human touch
face-to-face
and conversation face-to-face. Yeah. And it's hard to say, it's so easy to spout off online. It's hard to do it in person. It's hard to say a thing that is controversial for a lot of people. Or not controversial. It's hard to say something that's honest, I think, knowing it might be controversial to somebody else when you're in person.
But at the same time, Ken, so you just made a nod to that. If the professionals get a little tense about us, then what does that bode for the rest of the world? You know, just, you know, people who want to know and love God or talk about God. And that tension overrides the conversation.
Yeah, I think what I appreciate about religion journalists is that they're taking these conversations seriously. And no matter what their faith background is, or if they have no faith background at all, or no personal kind of conviction in the game, they take people of faith seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so while their conversations they might be having are tense, because there's weight to these conversations, and they appreciate that, and they try to bring that to the fore in their stories, they really listen to people of faith. They don't put aside the doctrines and the dogmas and the rituals and the practices that matter to these people. They center them in their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really appreciate about religion journalism in particular, is it doesn't try to sidestep the difficult stuff. It wades into it. It tries to help other people understand it. And I think in the end, it contributes to a more fruitful conversation on some of the most important and by that also tense issues of our
yeah,
time.
Yeah, hear, hear. Mm. I very much agree with that. Ken, in our remaining minutes, and we only have a couple, can you let us know about the conference? First of all, where it's going to be in Pittsburgh and what the conference schedule might be like?
Yeah, we're going to be at the DoubleTree Hotel downtown in Pittsburgh. We're going to be there from the 18th of April through the 20th of April. And I already mentioned some of our panels already about scandalous religion and covering the Israel-Hamas war from a local perspective. But we're also going to be talking about caste in America. Why is Eastern Orthodoxy attracting so many men? Mm. And then we're going to have an interactive panel on religion and food. So it is literally going to be all over the place in terms of topic. But we'll all be gathered there at the hotel. And then we're going to go to the Warhol Museum to celebrate our 75th anniversary, 75 years of being the premier professional organization for reporters writing on religion. And we can't wait to celebrate there and even dive into some of the religious themes with yeah. Warhol's art and Warhol's family as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So as we said
and
earlier.
Wait, karaoke. You did mention that. Have you decided on a locale for that?
There is a tradition of karaoke after the banquet, but you'll have to be there to get the secret handshake that tells you where we're going to be meeting. So
very nice. Okay. And so as we said earlier, Ken, I mean, this is open, right? I mean, you don't have to necessarily be a religion reporting professional to be part of this. You can just register online. Yes.
Yeah. We welcome people to come in. We love folks coming from the local community to be part of these conversations. And to meet journalists. If you're an emerging journalist or emerging writer or someone who's writing about something else and you're covering topics and you want to learn something more about religion, this is the place to do it. So we really welcome those people in particular, because as I said, I showed up 13 years ago at this conference, just a blogger from Houston coming in to have a conversation with folks. And I walked out with story ideas, pitches to editors, and an opportunity to make being a religion nerd my career. And I'm forever thankful to RNA for that. So I hope I meet someone like that in Pittsburgh next week.
Excellent. Ken Chitwood, he's president of Religion News Association, and they are in Pittsburgh, as we're saying, next week, the 18th through the 20th. Look online at rna.org for Religion News Association. Ken, enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
It is the stuff of movies. Two friends vow to marry each other if they are both not hitched by a specific future date or age. It is called the Marriage Pact, which is an annual matching ritual that has become popular on more than 90 college campuses around the United States. And a few couples have found, apparently, matching love. 500,000 students have participated since the pact first rolled out from Stanford University in 2017. Born of an economics project by two students there, the pacts involved an algorithm that rates matches based on such statements as, quote, I prefer politically incorrect humor and, or, I pride myself on telling hard truths. Unlike dating apps, each student gets just one name, a percentage on the quality of the match, and an email address to reach out. The idea is that if you think about everybody who goes to your college, surely there is someone who is a good plan, a backup plan for you. What do you think?
Okay. Well, I like the fact that
they're talking marriage.
Well, yeah. And I like the fact that they're it kind of takes the pressure off, because this, you're not trying to find the person, you're trying to find the backup person. which is, I mean,
it's silly.
It's silly.
On its core.
Okay, so can you think of movies where this is the case? I mean, the first movie I think of is When Harry Met Sally.
Right.
When Harry says, you're not doing anything on New Year's, then, you know.
Yeah, I'll be there.
But then later in the movie, she says, Harry, I am not your backup plan.
Exactly.
Right. So.
My second.
You're right. Lex, do you know of any movies? Can you think of any other movies where this was the thing?
Who's done this, right?
Not off the top of
my
head.
Yeah, all right. I mean.
Would you do that, Lexi?
A backup plan?
I don't think so. I think I'd have to know the person. I can't put it in an algorithm.
It doesn't seem serious at all.
No, it doesn't.
But
not.
Like I said, just the fact that people are even talking about marriage,
right,
perhaps is a good sign.
Right.
Right? I mean, I saw a billboard the other day, something about shacking up. They used the word shacking up. And they were sort of the billboard, as I drove by it, like in 3 seconds, apparently they were encouraging the idea of shacking up.
Okay.
Well, this is not.
Right. No, it does not.
You're saying I do.
So they have to be what age?
College age.
So, I know, but what age, like, does the pact come into?
Oh, it goes up to 26, to age 26.
Okay. So when you hit 26, if neither one of you are married, you've decided you're marrying each other.
I mean, how do you enforce anything like that?
Well, you don't. Of course, there's right. no enforcing you know,
so, it. I don't know. I mean, it just seems like maybe fun.
Okay, so is it easier to break up with your backup person than break up with the person you're actually dating?
There's nothing that binds you to that, right? It's just all, you know, just in case.
What about if there are people who weren't matched like that, but who are just friends who make a pact like that?
And maybe... That's a good point.
Because there's already a little bit of interest if you're making that pact.
Right. Better to be a friend than romantically involved.
Right.
And as that date draws closer, you go,
right.
You know,
Now, there have been a lot of movies like that.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
The marriage pact.
I don't know. Sometimes I think the person that you would choose, that you just like to hang out with, might end up in the long run being a better partner for you.
I mean,
I don't know.
Everybody's had those friends, right?
Yeah, everybody's had
friends. Well, heck, kind of like Kathy and Tim Keller.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they were hanging out. Yeah, during COVID, they told their story about how they met when they were in seminary. And Tim was dating somebody else, broke up with, and it was just, he and Kathy were really good friends. And we should replay that conversation.
Yeah. And Kath said, hey.
And Kath said, so, you know, like he said, well, I want us to just keep being friends. And she said,
No.
Sorry, you can't have me as a friend. You either date me or you don't have me.
Right. I mean, the phrase marriage-minded, remember that?
Yeah.
That's been bandied around a lot. I mean, it sort of feels like, you know, today's culture, like it's an antique. But people used to be
marriage-minded.
Yeah. Anyway, the marriage pact on 90 college campuses plus across the country. There are events that unite people, like a total solar eclipse, reminding us of our shared dependence of the sun, of course, but upon each other. Now, here's the weird news, that during the total eclipse, internet traffic in the United States, Mexico, and Canada dove downward. The people left their keyboards behind, even got off their phones. By the bazillions, millions and millions of people, it's quantified by the traffic, those who control the traffic or those who look at the traffic on the internet, and said it just dove down.
How about that?
So there are still some things. This is a major thing, because even like something like, you know, the Super Bowl, which draws people together, right? That communal event that happens every year, people are still on their phones.
Right.
So something like this. This is a rare opportunity for people to be together, right?
This was the ultimate analog event. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just it's the mechanics of space, and it's not amplified by anything digital. It's not experience through digital means. Mm-mm. It's just an analog thing. It's like getting water out of, it's like water out of a well.
Yeah.
It's just,
this is what, how
this
it
is
works.
How, this is the basics of the, how the universe works.
Yeah.
And I think that is more remarkable now than it ever was in pre-digital times, pre-internet times, because everything in our life is pretty much mediated through the digital world.
Unfortunately.
Our news comes that way. Our conversations with people come that way. Our photography comes that way. Our music comes that way.
Everything. Everything.
So it's very rare that you're in a situation that is that black and white.
So are there instances ever? I mean,
well,
this is a one-off.
Okay, so yes. So it's one-off. But it makes me think of live theater is analog.
Yeah.
You are there. You're hearing somebody
perform live.
Perform live. You're watching.
Hopefully not auto-tuned.
Right, exactly. It makes me think of live music. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing about going to a concert is if you're going to a stadium show, a lot of that is still mediated through digital means.
And people are on their phones
recording
what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Theater, though, is not like that mm-hmm. as much. So I feel like theater is one of those protected spaces. I also feel like if you're at a live sporting event, if you go to see, especially for some reason, I feel that way in hockey. I think because hockey is so different in person than it is on television to me, it's just a totally different sport.
Yeah.
That when you're there, it's so captivating and it's so fast that you can't be on your phone if you're at a hockey game.
But you do see this, right? I mean, there are key moments where everybody pulls their phone out and they're recording.
That's true.
Right?
But I would think for most of the hockey game, you don't have people on their phones.
It's too fast and furious.
I mean, yeah, it's too fast and furious.
But I'm
having trouble coming up with other
events that are singular.
Right.
The other day.
And nothing's as singular is what you're talking about.
No.
But anything I'm thinking that would approach it.
I mean, because the weirdness of the eclipse is, first of all, it got really dark, really fast. And if you, in totality only lasted, even at its peak, wherever you were, at its peak in some places, 4 minutes or less.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spend precious seconds
yes.
looking down at my phone
right.
while I need to see the beauty
right.
that was before me.
Right.
I drove hundreds and hundreds of miles to do this. So I'm going to make sure that I take this whole thing in.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other day there was it was the 50th anniversary of Hank Aaron hitting number 715. And there was a guy on the web I saw where he took a home movie camera. It was like a Super 8 camera. This is 50 years ago. So the technology, of course, very limited. So he was like one person in a crowd, like a fan, a super fan, shooting Super 8 of Hank Aaron.
Wow.
Well, that was an astounding thing, because if that happened today, right, whatever, like Kutch. I mean, Kutch is going to, you know, soon, hopefully, come upon his 300th home run.
Yeah.
Every time he comes up the bat, everybody pull, especially at PNC Park, people pull their phones out. They don't want to miss the moment. But you are taking yourself out of the moment while you're in the moment, because your phone is in front of you.
Right, you're
not really in the moment.
Right. No, you're not in the moment.
And you know what it's like to go to your kid's high school musical.
Does that drive you crazy?
Everyone's doing that.
Oh, my gosh. I hate that.
So you're out of the moment.
Yes.
Even though you're in the moment.
Right. Right. And that's the temptation, is that things are we recognize that life is so fleeting that we want to try to preserve it so that we can enjoy it again.
But you're becoming a cinematographer.
But you are. You're kind of a spectator on your own life.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. You're right.
I don't think it did.
I remember, you know, I was very sick on Monday. But I went outside shortly before the eclipse was going to happen. And I thought, I didn't have any glasses or anything because I had, you know, I had been really sick since Friday. So I just went out and sat in a chair and I thought, well, I just want to see what happens. Mm-hmm. I want to be in the yard and just kind of see. So I started maybe like, I think it was probably 30 minutes before. And it was really curious to me what that arc was like in my own tiniest corner of the globe, which was that there were people in my neighborhood. They were outside, but everybody was very quiet.
Was it cloudy here?
No. I mean, it was cloudy. It wasn't cloudy like it is today.
Yeah.
It was passing clouds.
Okay. So cool. So yeah. You could see if you wanted to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Definitely. And it was interesting because the birds were doing their thing. Everything was totally fine. And then as it started to get dark, we started to get toward totality, there was this rush of sound and this rush of activity. There were birds flying all around.
What's going on?
All around. And then when it was at its darkest, it was like they were fine. And then when it started to get light again, they were fine. But the color of the
horizon
of the light was so weird, so unusual, so unique.
I loved it so much.
I loved it. I really, really loved it. And looking back on it, I feel like I experienced it.
I'm
which
sure.
is different than I feel about other things that I used my phone to try to capture.
Mm-hmm. Because you were there.
And I even thought to myself, should I try to take a video of this? Not of the sun, but you know, of the
right.
what's. And then I thought, no, because then it was too big. It's kind of like trying to take a picture of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
When you're
it
doesn't even make sense. It's too immense. It felt too big to me.
Yeah. So my nerd astronomer son, he went up to Ohio to see it. And when he came home, I didn't talk to him when he came home. He was too exhausted. It was like a full day. But yesterday we sat in the yard. He talked to me for an hour about what his experience was.
Hmm.
And he said at some point, I need to write this down because I don't want to forget the feelings, which is essentially super analog.
Okay, so it is super analog. So why did this create feelings?
I can only speak for myself, but there was something about knowing, you know, because you would think about, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, when an eclipse happened, you didn't know it was
right,
going to happen.
Right.
There was no media telling you about. So right. Can you imagine like a farmer standing in a field and all of a sudden something totally different is happening. Night is upon us. There's something that was so powerful and so distant and so not in like my control of the celestial event where you would look up in the heavens and think the moon and the earth and the sun are now in some odd synchronicity. This has nothing to do with me.
Yeah. Or with any human
endeavor.
Nothing.
I'm a passenger.
Yeah. I'm a passenger. Interesting.
And I'm just... this is unfolding for me. And so visually, which is how most of us take in the world, we're seeing this come true. There's something that's happening here to me that I have no control over. And I just love the idea of it. And there was a simplicity, but I mean, it's a million miles, the moon, thousands of miles away, the moon, millions and millions of miles away,
right.
All conspiring that I can witness, that I'm part of, which made me think about, of course, God
right.
And the power of God in my life, that no matter what I fear or think or love or all those different things that are part of my tiny little blade of grass life.
Yeah.
I have no control over what's happening here.
Right.
It made me feel super tiny.
Wow.
But incredibly grateful to be able to witness this.
That's interesting.
I loved it so much.
You know, I didn't feel those things. I felt amazement because it was like, it was confirmation of what you see in a book. Or what you hear about is the predictable nature of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about that in theory so much, I forget that these are physical bodies. And seeing the total eclipse was like bringing me back to the fact that there are things in the universe that happen, that this universe is finely tuned, and I am watching that finely tuned ism right now.
Yeah, a front row seat.
And you know what else it made me think of? if the God we talk about has created these three celestial bodies, moon, earth, and sun, which are three out of billions, do you really think that you can fully comprehend that God? And do you think that God is interested in fitting into your box?
Nobel Prize-winning physicist Peter Higgs has died at the age of 94 from the University of Edinburgh. That's where the announcement came from. Peter Higgs, who was an emeritus professor at Edinburgh, is known for his discovery of the Higgs boson, a subatomic particle known colloquially as the God particle. Yep.
Now, I know that name. I know that term, I mean. But I couldn't tell you what it is.
Okay, so here in some concise from the AP, they talk about this. In 1964, Higgs theorized the existence of an energy field and an accompanying chargeless particle that gives other particles their mass and exists throughout the universe. For decades, physicists relied on the particle's existence to help explain quantum phenomenon, but could not detect it, leading one scientist to call it another name, shortened to God's particle. But in 2012, physicists used the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland to smash two beams of particles together at almost light speed, attempting to recreate condition moments after the Big Bang. The experiment, considered one of the most sophisticated in human history, detected the Higgs boson for the very first time, validating Higgs' theory. Today, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, which operates the LHC, continues to probe the foundations of particle theory, including a search for the never-before-seen ghost particle. So there it is.
Okay. So he believed that it was there, even though there was no evidence for it until they did that.
In Switzerland.
Experiment in Switzerland.
Right.
Okay.
The God particle, the existence of an energy field and an accompanying chargeless particle that gives other particles their mass and exists throughout the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you even theorize such a thing? Because I can't even make sense of what that is, the God particle.
Me neither.
But apparently it's in everything.
Yes. And in his calculations, he said there was no other way to explain the calculations without the existence of that particle.
Right. And so
So kind of it was proved by its absence almost, by its absence of being named until it was named. Wow.
Which is kind of like God in a way. Yeah. Right? I mean,
I believe in God. Everywhere, all over the universe.
It's my leap of faith in God.
Right, there has to be something there. So there has to be something that's giving its energy to other things.
So we have
giving its life to other things.
We have Cy Gart with us.
Biochemist.
I mean, he was an atheist. Now he's a believer.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
After months of planning, federal officials say 18-year-old Alexander Scott Mercurio was just a few days away from executing an attack on American soil in the name of the Islamic State militant group. Mercurio detailed his plot to a man in a hotel. The Idaho teen said he would want to walk into a church not far from his home in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, kneecap churchgoers with a metal pipe, kill them with a knife, set off fires using small butane canisters, and then try to wrestle a gun away from police officers once they arrived. He said he was committed to slaying as many people as possible before dying himself through suicide or by an encounter with law enforcement. The FBI, of course, that's who the guy was talking to, the kid was talking to. And the FBI has said that they are committed because they've seen on their radar many such instances where people in the name of the Islamic State and their ideology are wanting to attack specifically Christian churches. The case should be an eye-opener to the dangers of self-radicalization, mm-hmm. which is a real threat to our communities, said Shinoh Shihan, head of the FBI in Salt Lake City. The FBI was investigating a network that launders money for the militant group when agents came across Mercurio. How about that? We've been warned about
Thank
this.
Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, I'm sure there are a lot of stories like that that we don't know anything about.
Because
no doubt. The stories we know about are the ones that, you know,
find their way into leaks through the news media, right?
Or I was just saying the ones we know about are the people who weren't stopped by law enforcement. We don't know about the numbers of people who were stopped by law enforcement. So, I mean, oh, my. You're right. We've been hearing about this for a long time.
All these warnings that come our way,
especially
right?
Especially the last 8 or 9 months.
Right.
And the FBI director has spoken out about it. Secretary of State spoken about it.
I don't know. What is to be? I mean, anytime you gather, right? I mean,
it's a risk. It's a risk for anyone who gathers
in any
public place. But listen, there are places around the world where it's against the law of the land to gather.
Right.
So
we can't be afraid.
No, you cannot. We cannot.
We should go out into the world and live our lives.
You have to, right?
And we trust that law enforcement, in this case, doing an excellent job of keeping us safe.
Yes.
And as you say, Kath, many, many things that we're not even aware of that mm-hmm. are happening in this world. But we just go out and live, right?
Yep.
And have faith in the Lord of the universe to keep
yep.
us safe.
Yep.
And if it's not, so be it.
Yep, so be it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to our good friend Jay Werner Wallace.
Speaking of law enforcement.
That's right. Who's a former cold case detective. He's been featured on Dateline for a long time. Jay Werner Wallace has written a new book called The Truth in True Crime.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a fan of true crime podcasts, which are enormous in their popularity right now, or if you only watch Murders in the Building, then this will probably appeal to you very much. So stay close. It's the Wednesday edition of The Ride Home.
I know it's a huge genre, but true crime stories freak me out.
Hmm.
And so I tend to stay away from them.
Yeah.
How about you?
I think true crime stories are fascinating.
Do you engage?
I do engage, but in moderation, because I don't think they're all that good for me either.
No, right? There's a lot of baggage that goes with it.
Yeah, but man, they have exploded in popularity
since
podcasts became a thing.
Jay Werner Wallace is back with us. Jim has been a regular guest of ours over the many years we've done this show. He is a Dateline featured cold case detective, an author, a speaker, a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, adjunct professor of apologetics at Talbot School of Theology at Biola University. And he's the author of multiple books, which we love. But his latest looks fascinating. The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. You know, you're right, Kathy. It's a weird genre. And unsurprisingly, you said you probably watch a little more than John does. And that's pretty much true nationwide. Most viewers of true crime networks and shows are women.
Is that right?
The question becomes, well, yeah. And so the question becomes, like, why?
Why is that?
And, well, there's been some research and people are speculating on it. You know, it's hard to say. I think that part of it may be that, sadly, most suspects in these murders, like I've been on Dateline more than anybody, and I still watch a lot of Dateline because I love to watch the cases myself. And most of these suspects are guys. Mm. And I think sometimes, I mean, oftentimes when it's spousal murder, for example, which is featured a lot on Dateline, the victim's going to be the wife and the suspect's going to be the husband. So there's some speculation that women watch because they're kind of interested in making sure they don't fall into the same kinds of traps.
Okay.
Or watch your back.
You know, yeah. So who knows, though? But I think a lot of it is that we see things about human nature in true crime shows that either shocks us or confirm mm-hmm. something we already know to be true anyway. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to capitalize on this next book, because over the course of my career, I often saw things about human nature that was revealed in one case or another. And I thought, wow, and then you see it again, you see it again, and you see it again. Hmm. And these were the cautionary tales that I would tell my own kids when I was raising them, or anyone who asked me a question. You know, often, John and Kathy, you would call me if we're doing an interview, that's one thing. But if you're calling me personally, you're probably not calling me, you know, about the case for Christianity,
right?
Which I've written about a lot. You're probably calling me because you're thinking, oh, you know, I have this person in my life that kind of freaks me out. What do you think? And you're running this guy by me to see if you should be worried or not. In other words, you're calling me for a street smart kind of practical wisdom. And that's what this book is really all about.
Very good. Jim, early on, I mean, within the first few pages of The Truth and True Crime, you speak about one of the ultimate things in life, which is truth, something you discovered as a young boy hiding under the bed. Tell us that story.
Well, and I can tell you now, I'll just tell you this. This book I hope what it does is it provides you with 15 rules for life mm-hmm. that you can learn by investigating deaths, which I learned. And also, they're kind of cautionary tales, but they're also kind of life hacks. So you're going to get 15 true crime stories, 15 rules for life. But here's what's interesting about it. As I discover as becoming a Christian later in life, you know, the studies reveal that pretty much what I'm seeing in my murder cases are it's been confirmed by sociological studies, by research. But as I became a Christian, I realized it's also confirmed on the pages of the New Testament. So in other words, these are ancient principles that people dumb into and they kind of discover them by way of secular study years later. But they should have been known to all of us because they're ancient. As a matter of fact, Kathy, I think that's why we are interested in true crime, because we are designed in the image of our designer. We kind of understand what he wants from us and what helps us to flourish. And when you watch true crime shows, you see just the opposite sometimes, and it confirms for us what we innately know to be true because we're in the image of a designer. Now, John, you go back to your story.
Yeah.
You know, I had Lisa Childers write the foreword, and she talks about discovering truth by, you know, being caught under the bed by her parents.
Right.
You know, and I'll tell you something, that when she told me that story, I thought, well, this is kind of all of us. We kind of learn what's true by making mistakes. And that's one of the first chapters in the book is about the value of wisdom. What is wisdom? You know, is wisdom just knowledge? Is it something more? So what I tried to do in this book is to parse out these crime stories. And I'll tell you one thing that is, I think, important about this book. You know, one of the chapters is on identity and how we form our identity. And it turns out that identity formation is key to flourishing. Because if you look back over your lives, and all of us have a graph, you know, the peaks and valleys in our lives, pretty much every valley probably involved something that shook the way we saw ourselves. It shook our identity. You know, you're going along in life and you consider yourself happily married, and then suddenly get blindsided and now you're divorced. I'm no longer a married man. You're great at your job. Then you get fired or laid off. I'm no longer identified as that kind of employee or that kind of business. When I retired from my career in law enforcement, I tell you, it shook me. And it took me several years to figure out, well, who am I now? So it turns out that all the points of trauma in our life or the low points in our life are usually also involve a change in our identity. So the inverse is also true. If you can establish your identity in something that's unchanging, you will suffer less trauma because it won't shake who you are. And that's why I think it's so important for us. And I learned it, you know, retiring from the job. And the day I retired, I worked a case, which I describe in the book, in which a young man decided he wanted to kill himself because he was no longer who he thought he wanted to be. And I kind of like shook my head at that. And, you know, you do the case, you go on to the next call. And I get home and I realize, whoa, that was my last day on the job. And I realized I'm suffering the same thing. So identity is one of those things we talk about, one of 15 attributes of human flourishing we talk about in the book, that I hope people will say, yeah, that's a good true crime story here. But more importantly, there's something I can take away to live a better life.
Yeah. The new book is called The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. I am super geeked to read this. It just arrived in the studio yesterday. And Jay, I just like how you set the different chapters apart. And I'm thinking in particular of lead number 8, which is how to surprise yourself by flourishing after a trauma. So this is something that I'm sure you saw so many times in your career, which is looking at somebody who thinks that they're never going to be the same after witnessing a violent death, after losing somebody to violent death, especially a violent death that's unexplained. Can you talk about that and how you kind of formulated this chapter?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of this I kind of wrote after serving for many years with the Billy Graham Association, doing marriage resiliency counseling for officers who are involved in traumatic experiences and critical incidents. And I'll tell you, there's the research on this is pretty clear. We go along in life, we suffer a trauma, and then we are kind of our level of functioning is decreased, and we can PTSD. But there are people who kind of bounce back to where they were functioning before the trauma. That's called resiliency. But what I'm hoping for is for people to bounce back, not to where they were, but to a higher level of flourishing, which is called post-traumatic growth. And how people do it, according to all the secular studies, is what they call meaning-making. In other words, can you figure out how to make sense of your suffering in the context of your life? And those people who do, they flourish. Well, it turns out we are better at this than anyone else. It's not meaning making, it's meaning finding, because there's an overarching story of your life that God has written. And you got to figure out, this thing you just suffered, is this the final chapter? Or is this the climactic chapter after which you're going to have something? Every story has that kind of chapter, right? Oh, the trauma seems unsolvable. And then as the thing is solved, that's the climax of the story. Well, that's where you got to figure out, where does the trauma fit in the overarching story? And if Christianity is true, there is an overarching story. There's something that God might do with this trauma that could actually present to you an even better opportunity to bless those around you, to flourish on your own, and figuring out where that trauma fits in the overarching story of God's life for you is the key to flourishing after trauma. We describe this in the book. There's a case I mentioned in the book. It was a terrible case. But anyway, the point is, as I watched the family member after the murder flourish, after that she lost her sister, it was really powerful to me to watch how that played out. But again, what I'm trying to do here is just offer like principles, things that you can learn. And by the way, this idea of meaning finding is all through the scriptures, that we are not created to just suffer whatever happens in the cosmos. You know, sorry, if atheism is true, nobody really cares about you. There is no overarching story. There's just this blind, pitiless indifference of physics and chemistry governing the universe. On the other hand, if there's a God who has created you for a purpose, well, what you have to do is figure out, like, where does this event fit in God's overarching purpose for my life?
We're talking with J. Werner Wallace. His brand new work is called The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. Jim, before we met you, to be honest, I never thought about the murder of Jesus, that in some ways we are all cold case homicide detectives. I mean, our truth hangs upon the death of Jesus and his eventual resurrection.
Yeah, think about that as an overarching story. Like, Jesus always talked about this thing that was coming. And I think the disciples were like, either denied it or couldn't understand it. Or certainly, I'm sure on the cross, as he's dying on the cross, they're probably thinking, it's over. In other words, they didn't understand where this terrible event fit in the overarching story written by God beforehand. And that's where I think all of us, I think Jesus is a perfect example of an overcomer. Right? That we, and that's not what we're here. We're not here to follow Jesus's example so we can be overcomers. But there's a perfect example, though, of how the story of God, it was not complete in that moment, and that we have to look beyond that moment to see how the story concludes. Well, it's not just that he provides an example. It's that he provides all of the power to overcome. Because without that, we're just willing ourselves to overcome. Well, if you trust, you surrender and trust in the power of the God's Holy Spirit, well, then you know that it's not just you trying to rethink your life and will yourself to a better life. No, it's actually you surrendering to the overarching story. And that's where I think that the story of the resurrection has more power than just our salvation. Of course, first and foremost, it's about our salvation. But that does actually have an example for us that we could use to understand how to overcome the trauma.
So good.
Jay Warner Wallace is with us. The Truth and True Crime is his latest book. You know, Jim, I think what you've done here is what every Christian should be doing in every avenue of curiosity, which is, you know, if you love a movie, you and you're a Christian, you have to see that movie.
Break it down.
Through the lens of the story that God has given us. And that's something frivolous like watching a movie. But if you experience a great loss in your life, it's the same thing. That's what we talked about a few minutes ago. The Christian sees it through the larger story. And looking at true crime, which is so popular right now, not just in podcast form, but also in TV, streaming, movies, whatever it is, seeing that through a Christian lens, I just think it's a fabulous idea for a book. And it just looks really compelling to me. I haven't even gotten more than, 30 pages into it.
Well, your entire story, Jim, sorry, you as an atheist, you come to faith because of true crime in some way.
Yeah, it was this experience that brought me to see the true nature of people, the true nature of myself. But you're right. I mean, look, all of us have some role to play in this. I'm just using this going in this direction because this is the direction of my career and the direction of my life. But you're right, wherever you are. And I will say this. I always say that people should exhaust what's available for free before they buy a book, before they pay for something. So I'm always uncomfortable that, now we've got this new book. So what I try to do is offer so much free content that goes along with the book. And that's what we've tried to do here. And so if you go to our truthandtruecrime.com website, thetruthandtruecrime.com, you'll see that for a pre-order, because now we're still in pre-order, doesn't publish till May 7th, I've offered a bunch of free ebook that goes along with this book, free opening chapters you can start reading immediately, and also a long hour-long video on how to overcome trauma. We just got done talking about it. That's just one chapter of the book, but I offer that as one of the freebies, basically, for pre-order. Here's what I would say. Whoever you are listening to this, God's using your life and your career. And you may not think, well, that's got no application to the gospel. Why would a cold case homicide detective have any application to the gospel? I bet you there is a way that you can leverage your experience, your career, to share the gospel with somebody from your unique point of view. Don't wait. Do it now.
Excellent. Jim, you do such wonderful work. We're grateful for our friendship with you and our long association. I mean, keep it up. The work you do is incredibly vital. We appreciate your time here.
Well, you're my first interview ever on radio. And as of today, you're my last interview on radio also. So that's pretty good, right?
Hey, how about that?
Appreciate you having me.
The book is
awesome.
No, come back. It won't be the last one.
Yeah,
that's right.
All right, thanks.
The new book is called The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. The author, Jay Warner Wallace. Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Tissues with lotion.
Oh.
I started to get sick on Friday evening, and I stopped at my local Rite Aid. And I got two boxes. I thought, I'm going to be blowing my nose a lot. So I got two boxes, 60 tissues each, with lotion. And I went home. And I used all of the tissues by Monday evening. Okay, so that's a lot of nose blowing if you think about it, right? I mean, if only one nose blow per tissue, it's 120, but it was several. Anyway, I was using them a lot. You think that makes any sense? Difference? Help?
Yes. Because it's one thing to have a runny nose, but then all the wiping causes abrasions. I mean,
does it cause abrasions?
I think it does, right? And then you have the humiliation of like a sore upper lip.
Right, yeah. And it's like you're in third grade again.
Exactly. So I would generally poo-poo the, lotion Kleenex. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing it like it's your only job, it makes perfect sense. You think?
I'm totally with you on this, John.
Hey, okay.
I bought it only because I needed something to make myself feel better, because I could feel the descent of the head cold coming.
Here it comes.
But after using them that regularly for all of those days, I don't have any nose irritation, really.
Uh-huh.
I really don't. I feel like it preserved me.
I think you're right.
I feel like from now on, should I have the head cold feeling, I think I'm going to reach straight for the lotion tissues.
I think, if you're headed into that tunnel.
Yeah. But you have to save them for that time.
Right, right. Just as
you
a casual.
You can't have them around your house at another time.
No, you just use a Kleenex or a napkin.
Just, right.
All right, so with that same thread of the cold and suffering, nighttime NyQuil, does that make sense?
Well, if you would have asked me 5 days ago, I would have said absolutely not. I've never taken NyQuil. Well, I was so desperate on Friday night. I took it.
Of course you did.
I took it and I used it.
And did you love it?
Oh my gosh. It helped me so much. My head was so packed for 3 days, almost 4 days, that I thought I would never have slept.
No, you need a good night's sleep. It's your only respite.
Listen, I am a big fan now. Mm-hmm. I took the honey.
Oh, yeah.
The severe, whatever it was.
Sure, yeah. Knock me out exactly. Until the rapture comes, NyQuil.
I'm totally in for it. You agree, John?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, seriously, it's like... It's the great cure-all.
It is really wonderful.
You need to heal, and sleep is a good healer.
I spoke incorrectly. I know not of what I spoke before.
Earlier in the show, we were talking with the president of the Religion News Association. And we're curious because, you know, we're knee-deep in religion news and religion thought. Now, of course, things come down the pike... let me just say that, you know, case in point, the Vatican releases a new document. Now, if you're a Protestant and you go, well, the Vatican's releasing a document, that has nothing to do with me. Who cares what the Vatican has to say? Well, I would caution against that kind of thought because in many ways, what comes out of the Vatican informs us from a
Christian perspective.
Yes. Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Dr. Charles Camosi is back with us. Charlie's been a regular guest of ours over the many years. He's professor of medical humanities at the Creighton University School of Medicine, author of 7 books, including Beyond the Abortion Wars and Resisting Throwaway Culture. His most recent book is Bioethics for Nurses, A Christian Moral Vision. But he's here today to talk to us about the takeaways from Monday's release of the Vatican's document on human dignity. Dr. Camosi, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you again.
Charlie, so happy to talk to you today about this because looking at the initial document, I thought I'm going to need somebody to translate some of this for me.
you're
my favorite person to do that, of course. This document was issued Monday, and it basically is a conversation about how the Catholic Church is dealing with current and contemporary social issues. What's interesting about the document to me is how different it seems in tone to how the Pope usually expresses himself. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, that's at least one very popular take on this. And to a certain extent, that's right. I mean, let's just get into the weeds a little bit of what this document is, first of all. There's something called the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is actually the old Holy Office, which doesn't have a great reputation, but bad things happen to people as a result of the Holy Office work in the Middle Ages. But now it kind of serves as a teaching tool of the Church, and so Pope Francis any Pope would have to approve of what comes out of that office, but it's a separate office, and it's almost certainly the work of multiple authors. And Pope Francis took a look at it. He saw a draft of it. He made suggestions for improvement. But this is not, you know, Pope Francis has approved this, but this is something that is the product of multiple people. So that's part of the reason for the difference in the kind of tone.
Got it.
But here's something else that's important to emphasize. Abortion is a good example of this. Pope Francis has always spoken with pastoral care for women, including women that have had abortions. But then he's spoken up just as clearly about the truth of abortion, right? I think I mentioned this before on your program. Pope Francis has likened abortion to hiring a hitman, a white glove Nazi crime. He said, let's not mince words. This is homicide. And so this does not get covered the same way his pastoral stuff, which some people call mealy mouth and weak kneed and, you know, whatever. And some people love is like finally reaching out to the marginalized and those who, you know, are like the woman at the well, or the woman caught in the act of adultery like Jesus did. But Jesus himself was like this, too. We don't need to focus on Pope Francis or the Catholic Church. This is who we're trying to imitate here. The one who says, you know, to the woman caught in the act of adultery, has no one condemned you, neither do I condemn you, but then don't go sinning anymore, right? Stop sinning.
Yeah.
And that's what this document is really about. It's a document about human dignity and the attack, different kinds of attacks on human dignity. And it is more in the key, to finish up this overly long point, it is in the key of saying, don't go sin anymore. Like we said a lot about the, I'm not condemning you, this is, we're having a pastoral outreach, but at the end of the day, the assaults on human dignity need to stop.
Good. So, Charlie, at the heart of this document release, the Pope talks about gender fluidity, about sex as a person, the sex a person is born with is a gift from God, about the Vatican's, the surrogacy and the commercialization, a lot of different things about sexuality, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, the Pope has spoken out about all these things already multiple times, condemned surrogacy. I think we talked about that on your show, like even wants to make it illegal, thinks it's exploitive, think it doesn't respect the relationship between sex and procreation. Women are exploited. The children are exploited, thrown away. But the real bombshell here was really the stuff about sex and gender, right? I mean, this Pope, again, has spoken with a ton of pastoral care for people who identify as transgender. But then the language in this document lays the hammer down and does say, yes, pastoral care, yes, welcome, yes, no discrimination. But at the end of the day, I mean, listen to this language. It needs to be emphasized, this is a quote, it needs to be emphasized that biological sex and the social cultural role of sex can be distinguished but not separated. So sex, gender, connected, right? They're not. It's not as if you can be one sex and change your gender, in other words. Therefore, all attempts to obscure reference, this is back to the quote, obscure reference to the illimitable sexual difference between men and women is to be rejected. We cannot separate the masculine and the feminine from God's work of creation, which is prior to all our decisions and experiences where biological elements exist, which are impossible to ignore. This is a gift from God. Our human nature is a gift from God, and our sexual nature is part of that gift. And this is part of what the Pope understands as human dignity. If we say, well, no, there's nothing fixed here. There's nothing given here. It's completely up to ourselves, our predilections, our understandings, our self-understandings, our autonomy, our way we, you know, thinking of the body as a canvas on which to paint our kind of self-understanding of our identity, which, by the way, I have to say, one of the worst things we've done to young people is to tell them they have no story, they have no identity, you created right. all yourself. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility.
Giving them that kind of burden. This document is saying, no, that's not true. You're given a particular identity. It's a gift from God.
Right. And build upon that and get to know it better.
Build upon that. Yeah, and get to know it better. That's right. That's right.
So surrogacy has been opposed by the Vatican historically. This Vatican document reiterates the opposition to surrogacy and in vitro fertilization. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So, again, this is part of the givenness of human nature, of the body, of what it means to be human, of human dignity. And to the extent that, you know, medical interventions affirm that God-given dignity, that God-given nature, the Church is obviously, and Christians more broadly, of course, are in favor of that, right? Like, for instance, if someone has difficulty conceiving and there's something wrong that can be addressed, you know, medically, the Church runs hospitals and clinics that address those things, to try to fix those things. So the Church is not against working within God's plan of human dignity to better, conceive children. In fact, that's a great gift that the Church and other Christian hospitals and clinics do all the time. The key here, and again, I think we may have talked about this on your show before, is to think about, well, what, you know, how much can we go against human nature? How much can we go beyond human nature? How much can we manipulate human nature and step into other realms where, for instance, you know, we have now we can have five parents, right? We can have the parents who want a child, right? The mother and the father, or I guess in some cases, two mothers or two fathers. You have the surrogate mother who carries the child, and then you can have the donor of the sperm and the donor of the egg. And so you have five different parents, all of whom have some sort of significant connection as parents to the child. I mean, I guess now with technology, you could have even more parents, right? We can now splice people's genes into the gametes and have multiple kind of genetic codes put into the sperm or the ova. and have it go beyond that, but at least five parents. Now, that is obviously something from at least a Catholic perspective that says this goes beyond the kind of plan that God has for humanity, our human dignity. In fact, it manipulates and exploits human beings in ways that are not fair to the human beings themselves, to the child in particular. And so to the extent that any of these things violate, again, the gift of human nature, of dignified human nature, we ought to say no to them.
One of the things that is clear, and you brought this up earlier in our conversation, Charlie, is that the Pope has been personally welcoming and affirming mm-hmm. to people. Yes, please come to church. Yes, you know, I want to shake your hand. I want to interact with you. And yet his opinion on the larger societal trends is unchanged. And to me, I'm reading the article in the New York Times, they're kind of flummoxed by that, where to me, I feel like mm-hmm. that's a really good example for all of us. How do you see that?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have seen some of the commercials that have been on. It's not one thing, it's two things. I think Travis Kelce did one of those. It's been beer commercials.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is kind of a helpful way to think about what Pope Francis is doing. It's not one thing, it's two things. And that's what flummoxes the New York Times, Washington Post, others, because they think it can only be one thing. It can only be, or what acceptance means only one thing. It means affirming what it is that someone is doing, right, in the fullness of what they're doing. Pope Francis is doing two things. He's saying, yes, you are welcome, no to discrimination. We are going to bring you into the community. This is what Christ did, right? I'm going to take the slings and arrows that people say, you shouldn't be eating with those people. You shouldn't be hanging out with those people. Those are the sinners. Those are the bad ones. But the second thing, as we just mentioned earlier in this conversation, is to also say, I'm going to hang out with you. I'm going to welcome you. Matthew, the tax collector, you're going to stop doing that.
Yeah. Right.
And you're going to pick up your cross and follow me. A woman who is caught in the very act of adultery, you're going to stop doing that. Woman at the well who has seven husbands, it's time to stop with that stuff, right? I am going to engage you and I'm going to love you. I'm going to speak with you as if you have the dignity God has given you. But then I'm also going to speak the truth in you. This is the classic, I can't help but be a Catholic moral theologian here about Catholic popes and thinkers, but Benedict XVI wrote a encyclical that's one of my favorites called Caritas in Veritate, speaking the truth in love. Mm. I think that's where we need to live. You know, we care about two things as Christians, right? We care about truth and love, and we hold them in balanced tension with each other.
Yes. So the takeaway here, Charlie, is that whether you're a Catholic or not, whether you care about the Vatican or not, I mean, these are essential truths that need to be said out loud. A line in the sand has to be drawn, whether you agree with those teachings or not. This is what life is.
That's one of the key parts of this document, it seems to me, and I hope it can call both Catholics and non-Catholics to this as well. It's a call to speak the truth, and the truth is love, and the truth is truth, right? So we got to do it in a way that's loving and pastoral and reflects the love that Christ had for everyone, including the most despised and the outcast. The kind of language that is used in this document to call people to truth, when it comes to abortion, for instance, the prophet Isaiah is invoked as a warning, saying, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. Mm-hmm. Remember that part from
Isaiah?
That is quoted explicitly to those who distort the truth of what happens to a baby in abortion, right? And saying it's time to stop. It's time to say woe to you who don't speak the truth about this, about gender theory. But I mean, it's not just about these things. Can I just read off a very quick list of the things it talks about? Poverty, war, immigrants, human trafficking, sex abuse, violence against women, abortion, surrogacy, euthanasia, people with disabilities, gender theory, sex change, and digital violence is the last one. I mean, that's an incredibly wide range and politically diverse range of things to be right about. And that's where I think we ought to live as Christians. We're not committed to a kind of right-left political dichotomy. We're committed to the gospel. And how human dignity shows up is it can't be fit into these right-left binaries. That's one thing I love about this document.
Amen.
Dr. Charles Camosi, professor of medical humanities at the Creighton University School of Medicine. You can check out one of Charlie's books, Beyond the Abortion Wars or Resisting Throwaway Culture. Thanks so much, Charlie. Good to talk to you.
Same here. Have a good one.
How long has the coffee shop been a thing?
Mm.
I mean, remember growing up, there really wasn't, you know, a coffee shop,
mm-mm,
right?
No.
I mean, there was a place to grab a cup of coffee, usually like in a white styrofoam cup. But then, like, trendiness set in.
Yeah. And I want to say the 80s. I remember the Beehive was the first coffee shop I can think of.
Yeah, on Carson Street.
On Carson Street.
Mm-hmm. Which I love the Beehive.
So did I.
But, well, weren't they in Oakland first?
Oakland, too. No, they were in the South Side first,
okay,
I think. And then they were in Oakland. I could be wrong.
They're
about
both
that.
Gone. Both locations are gone.
Yeah.
Both were sort of funky.
Alternative hangouts.
Right. They weren't certainly corporate Starbucks.
Mm-mm.
They were like, you know, dirty couches,
right,
and, you know, kind of messy
and
tables.
And some dirty people.
Yeah. It was a real neighborhood, true hangout,
yeah,
right? A coffee shop where you just go in and grab a cup and hang out for a little bit. I went to the Beehive often, especially,
sure,
on the South Side. I was working, doing theater down by City Theater there. But now I rarely go into a coffee shop.
Is that right?
If I'm doing coffee, I'm doing a drive-thru.
Okay. Well, I mean, I, just like a lot of you, I really appreciate Starbucks. I don't drink all that much coffee, but I drink tea, and they have several very good teas there.
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely despise the interiors
of Starbucks.
Hate them.
The aesthetic is...
I hate it. It's gray. It's cold.
Mm-hmm.
It's brown. It's dark.
At the same time,
it's,
people live there.
I know.
Right? They hang out there forever,
right,
and ever,
total,
and ever.
Total personal choice.
Yeah.
I just very much dislike it. So I never go inside. If I'm going to Starbucks, I'll do a drive-thru, but I'm never going to go, right, hang out in there.
Okay, so Next Pittsburgh did a breakdown on the best coffee shops in Pittsburgh. Now, it always comes with a caveat. It's based upon listener voting.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could stuff the ballot box.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
But there was a winner in, what, Coriopolis?
Yeah. The Queen Beans Cafe in Coriopolis.
Don't know it.
Is the winner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard of it, so I went online and looked and appreciated their website. But Lexi has been there herself.
Right.
Lex, could you report back?
It's an absolute joy to go in there.
Is
it's
it?
So bright. You were talking about how Starbucks has that real, like, corporate,
I,
like, cold feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Walking in there, it's so joyful.
Yes.
Like, it's all bright and yellow. Bees are the kind of, like, theme for it. So there's, mm-hmm, a lot of yellow. They have a really cute flowery decor.
Nice.
And their coffee is amazing. And their sandwiches are really good.
No kidding.
And they have baked goods, too?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do.
Uh-huh.
Very nice.
Yeah. Okay. So would you put that in one of your favorite local coffee shops, Lex?
I probably would.
Okay.
One, because it's very close to where I live.
Uh-huh.
I'm not too far away from Queen Beans.
Okay. So Kath and I have admitted we are not, you know, hanging out at coffee shops like we used to.
Right.
In my neighborhood, over my neck of the woods in the East End, Biddle's Escape.
Never been
one
there.
Of those my wife frequents this coffee shop.
And where's that?
It's in Wilkinsburg.
Okay.
On Biddle Avenue.
Okay.
Right?
And you know that too, Lex?
I do.
Look at,
oh,
she's getting around.
Look at what's going on with Lex in the coffee shop. What do you think of Biddle's?
Oh, it's very fun in there.
Okay.
Very interesting to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cafe Bites as well. My wife always says the pastries are to die for. Mm-hmm. All right. I remember going in Squirrel Hill on Murray Avenue, 61B, which
I've
is the
walked
bus.
Walked past that a lot.
I mean, that to me is like is as old as.
But the Beehive.
The Beehive. It's been around forever, probably since the '80s.
Okay.
Right? And the guy who owns that is an old film guy. He used to run filmmakers.
Mm. Pittsburgh filmmakers.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Really.
And there's not much of an aesthetic there, a vibe. I mean,
okay,
it's just kind of like a neighborhood hangout.
All right.
And people do kind of like take root in the place.
Mm.
How about people who live in coffee shops, right?
Yeah.
With their laptops,
I'm sure that's,
and whatnot.
Not pleasant for the coffee shop.
Well, they're probably regulars, hopefully. Right?
Yeah, but they're probably also taking up a table.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got two coffee shops that I really like.
Okay, tell me.
And I don't drink a lot of coffee, but when I do, I get serious about it.
Really?
Big Dog Coffee is in the South Side. It's on Sarah Street, 2717. I'd never been there until a couple months ago. My friend Catherine took me there. I love Big Dog Coffee.
Hmm.
I love how it feels inside.
like, what's the feel?
It feels like an actual coffee shop. I'm going to show you a picture.
Oh, that's very pretty.
It's just...
Yeah, lots of wood. Yep. There's a big bar there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a big marble top.
Nice wicker chairs or
yep.
some sort.
It's
very nice.
It's really nice. The
place
other
to hang out?
Place to hang out. Mm-hmm. And I really like Defer on Smallman Street in the Strip District.
Okay.
Defer has a nice, you know, garage door that opens in the summer.
Sure,
so it's got
a lot of
air moving through. It's the best vanilla latte in town.
Interesting.
At Defer.
Okay. Bloomfield has Yinzer.
Yeah, on the corner.
Yeah. Which used to be like Laughing Goat or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
I think it...
They come and go.
Yeah.
It's kind of a tough business to be in,
yeah.
don't you think?
Uh-huh.
Trendiness or, you know, yeah, Yinzer Coffee. I just drive by there and go, okay, there's an ode to Pittsburgh kind of thing.
Sure.
Yinzer.
Lex, any other ones you love?
Right down the road from Queen Beans, actually, is Anchor and Anvil, which is, fun fact, where I had my first date with my boyfriend.
Oh. Get out!
And it's now, we are now regulars there. It's great.
Anchor and Anvil.
Very nice. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A little shout out.
All right, give them a shout.
All right. I mean, that's always a nice gift to give someone, like a gift card
I like
from their
that.
Favorite coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
right? Very nice.
Mm-hmm. That makes me have a little yearning for an iced
coffee.
Vanilla latte.
I've had two cups today.
Have you?
Two cups. I generally do two cups.
Do you? Every day?
Jimmy.
I have coffee maybe once every couple of weeks.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy, a production of Salem Media Group.